The scripture reading this morning comes from Hebrews chapter 7, verses 23 through 25. Now there have been many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing in office, but because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them.
It's always good when I get up here and there's an error message on the iPad. It always makes me feel like things are going to go well. Oh, there it is. Okay, we're good now. Well, good morning. And now it's a good morning. Before it was not so sure. But we're going to continue our series out of the book of Hebrews. This is the second lesson dealing with the priesthood of Christ specifically. When I was working out kind of how I wanted to lay these out, I was concerned at first. Four lessons seemed like a whole lot to spend on the priesthood of Christ, but then it occurred to me that's exactly how long the text spends on it, so maybe I'm going to have to do that. The text feels it's very important that you think about and contemplate the priesthood of Christ and all that it entails, and so we're going to try to do that this morning. Last week, we talked about Christ the obedient priest and the significance of Christ as one who could be perfectly reverent. Unlike the priest of the past in the Levitical system, who had to open up their services by looking for forgiveness for their own sins before asking for anybody else, the Christ that we have as the high priest, this Messiah, is a flawless moral individual who does not have to begin his days with prayers for his own sins, but rather can stand before God in perfect holiness and reverence. We're going to skip chapter 6, but looking in chapter 7 today, we want to consider another attribute of Christ that makes him a great high priest, and that is he is a permanent high priest. Now, I have to tell you, I failed miserably as a preacher this week. Preaching is as much about leaving things out as putting things in and kind of honing your point down to one point and not 30 points. I only wanted to preach on Hebrews chapter 7, 23 through 28. Didn't happen. I'm going to end up preaching pretty much on the entire chapter because there's just no way I could figure out how to start in verse 23 without presupposing I had said something about the other verses. So what we're going to do, very quickly, without even reading the text, I want you to have your Bible open to Hebrews 7. You can kind of follow along in the text. I'm just going to summarize about the first 22 verses of Hebrews 7 and just give you the basic idea of what that text is about, because the main point I want to get to starts in verse 23. What are the questions behind the text? Last week, we talked about how one of the questions was, did following Christ mean giving up the priesthood? Okay, that was one of the Jewish arguments. If you follow this Messiah, you don't have a priest. And so that was one of the questions we talked about last week. This week, we have a specific question added to that. Is it blasphemy to even suggest you could have a living or a priest who is better than the Levitical priesthood? And that's a serious accusation. Before, the writer is saying Christ can be our high priest, and that's a good thing. He's better than Aaron. This week, I think he seems to be heading off the concern, this is borderline blasphemy. The Levitical priesthood wasn't pulled out of thin air. God made the Levites priest. God made the descendants of Aaron priest. How dare you even speak of someone else being priest? That's just nearly blasphemy. And so I think he's heading off that concern by giving us another quality of the priesthood of Jesus Christ that sets him apart, that he is a permanent priest, and there's never been a priesthood like that. He begins in verses 1 through 10 by saying a bit about Melchizedek. Last week we had kind of a parenthetical statement. The writer wants to say something about Melchizedek, and we just don't have time for that. Well, this week we have a little time for it. We're going to say a little bit about Melchizedek. What is the story of Melchizedek? He is, in reality, if you were just to read the Old Testament, one of the most unimportant characters in the Old Testament. He gets a solid two or three verses in the book of Genesis. And that's actually the point of the writer of Hebrews, that he is a side character. He's a bit part. He is You know, when a famous actor kind of pops into your favorite show for a moment and then pops out of his cameo 3 minutes later, and that's all you get. That's kind of, this is a cameo part in the book of Genesis, where this person named Melchizedek shows up. Melchizedek is the king of Salem. Salem is the city that would later be named Jerusalem, right? So Salem is ultimately Jerusalem. So this is an important place, but this is before the Jewish folk have control of the city, before David marches on it. This is long before that, when it's still some city called Salem. And the king of this city is a man named Melchizedek, which in the Hebrew text is like the coolest name. Salem means peace, it's shalom, so he's the king of peace, but his name is derived from the Hebrew Melchizedek, which means king of righteousness. So how do you get better than that? The king of peace is the king of righteousness. He's got a great name, and the Hebrew writer likes to play with that here in these verses. Okay, so he's an interesting figure in that sense, but we don't know a lot about him. All we know is that Abraham encounters him after his war. Abraham went into conflict, armed conflict, in the book of Genesis. And when it was over and he's victorious, he comes back and he meets, for no particular reason, the king of Salem, Melchizedek. And when he meets him, as an act of gratitude to God for his victory, he makes use of Melchizedek as a priest of the Most High. And he offers to Melchizedek a tenth, a tithe, of the spoils of his campaign. Unlike the Levite priest, we don't know anything about Melchizedek. If you are a Levitical priest, you need to know who your father was, who your father's fathers was, who your father's father's fathers was. You need to have a sense of your lineage all the way back as far as you can go, connected to a legitimate line of Aaronide succession to the priesthood. This is essential. In the book of Ezra, there's a discussion of some who wanted to be priests after the captivity in Babylon who were refused the priesthood, not because they weren't Levitical, but because they couldn't prove it. Because they couldn't establish their lineage, they could not serve in the priesthood. But then there's this person, Melchizedek. And the writer of Hebrews is really kind of flowery here. I think he speaks in hyperbole, and I think some people get distracted by that. He says, Melchizedek has no father or mother. Now, that's not to say Melchizedek pops out of nothing, right? Like just one day there's no Melchizedek, and boom, he's there, right? That's not what it's saying. But in the world of the story, who are Melchizedek's parents? I don't know. We have no idea. He can't give you his mother and father. He can't give you his grand. We don't know anything about this person. He has no succession. The text says, Melchizedek neither is born nor does he die. And I don't take that to be literally, again, that he just kind of pops into existence or that he continues forever or anything like that. What I take it to mean is that in the world of the story, he's a figure without any context. If you're a Levitical priest, I can say the high priest from this year was so-and-so who was appointed at this time. He died in this year, and then the next person became the high priest. I can tell you when they're born. I can tell you when they die. I can tell you where their parents are. I can tell you everything about the Levitical priesthood. But in Genesis, you have this person who comes out of nowhere. We don't know who his parents are. He has no line of succession. And he, as far as the text goes, doesn't live or die. I mean, he just is, and he takes the tithe of Abraham, and off he goes. That's it. So what's the point of this? What is he trying to say here? Verse 4, see how great this man was. The point the text is going to make about Melchizedek is to just test your imagination a little bit. You're saying in your mind, well, there could never be a better priest than the Levitical priesthood. And the writer says, actually, the law talks about a priest who was better than the Levite priest was. We don't know much about him, but here's what we know. The Levites are the descendants of Abraham. Okay? One of the cardinal rules of ancient world interpretation, father's in charge, right? Father has more importance than son. Grandfather has more importance than grandson, right? The authority comes from the top down. Levi is a couple generations down from Abraham. Abraham treats Melchizedek as his priest. So if Abraham, who's greater than Levi, and Levi's greater than Aaron, and Aaron's greater than all the priests that follow after Aaron, if Abraham could recognize Melchizedek as a priest, Well, then see how great a man this is? Clearly, this is a priest who can be imagined, at least, to be greater than the Levitical priesthood, because his authority isn't derived from Levi or even Abraham. It's Abraham who treats him like a priest. Okay, and that's the point being made here. Melchizedek was greater than Abraham, who himself was greater than all the priestly descendants of Levi, his great grandson. The point is, even the law could talk about a priest who is greater than the Levites. And that's the big point. So you're a Jewish person in the first century. Well, if we follow this Jesus person, we don't have a priesthood anymore. The Christians come back and say, Jesus is our priest, and he's a better priest. Now, hang on, you can't have a better priest than the Levites. It says so in the law. Actually, the law says there was at least one who preceded the Levites, one who was there receiving the priestly offerings of Abraham himself. One who didn't need the things you think you need to be a priest. Pops out of nowhere and goes right back to nowhere when he's done. So that's the big literary point being made in the first 10 verses that sets up the rest of the chapter. In verses 11 through 19 then, what we're going to read is that if the Levite priesthoods were so great, why then do we have this story of Melchizedek? Doesn't it kind of undermine the story? If you're trying to tell the world, if you're God and you're writing a book, and your point is only the Levites could ever be priests and they're the greatest priests that could ever be, why do you feel compelled to throw in this story about Melchizedek? It's totally unnecessary, right? It doesn't help you with Abraham in any way. But there, out of nowhere, here's the story of Melchizedek. The writer says, if the Levite priests are so great, why this story about Melchizedek? If the Levite priests are so great, why wasn't the Messiah a Levite? This is a second point. In the Old Testament, they're promised a Messiah, an anointed one, but the text is very clear he's a descendant of David. He's of the tribe of Judah, the lion of the tribe of Judah. But Moses was very clear the priests are Levites. And yet Zechariah the prophet, here I'm getting way off the page, but Zechariah the prophet says he'll be a priest upon his throne. Now, if the Levitical priesthood was the permanent forever priesthood that God intended, why is the Messiah promised to be of the tribe of Judah and not Levi? So we got points on either end. You got the Levites in the middle. Melchizedek is a priest beforehand. Messiah is a priest afterwards. Neither one of them are Levites. Are you sure the Levites are such a great priesthood? That's the point being set up here. The priest of Christ, the priesthood of Christ looks more like the Melchizedek priesthood than Levi, and the author's trying to tell us that's a good thing. Okay? That's a good thing. So in verses 20 through 22 then, he drives home this point a little further. He says, let me tell you one more thing that makes the priesthood of Christ so good. He says the priest in the Old Testament swore an oath. When you were appointed, they swore an oath to act as a priest. The Messiah is not going to swear an oath. God swears the oath for him. Let's read just a little bit here, verses 20 through 22. And it was not without an oath, for those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath, but this one was made a priest with an oath by the one who said to him, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever. This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. Before, you had a priesthood who said, you know, yeah, I'll do the job as a priest. But has there ever been a priest in history of whom God has said, he will be a priest forever? Has God ever sworn an oath on his behalf? So already we're starting to think, this is something more than we've seen before. Not only is he a priest, God swears his oath. Not only is he a priest, when God swears the oath, he uses this little word, forever. And that's a daunting word, because that's something that nobody could ever claim until Jesus himself. Finally then, with all that in mind, I know we're moving really fast to summarizing, we get to what I want to talk about today, which is the permanence of the priesthood of Christ. Based on this story of Melchizedek, he's going to tell us, here is something that is substantially better than anything you've had before. Look with me in verses 23 and following. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But he holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. This is a new argument, and it's still the same point. You're concerned about the Levitical priesthood, he says. But he says, were your Levitical priest ever that good? Number one, let's say a Levitical priest was as good as they could possibly be. Let's think of your favorite priest in Jewish history, the best priest who ever was priest. Okay? You know what happened when he grew old? He died. And his son was an idiot. Hey, so that's not in the text. It kind of is. There's a long-standing Jewish understanding that great men typically don't have great sons. Okay? Read your Old Testament. Find a great man in the Old Testament, and what do his children do? They're lousy. They're terrible. Right? Okay? All of the children go the other direction. Eli's son, when Eli was serving in the tabernacle, his sons are terrible. Samuel, when Samuel is prophet and judge in the land, Samuel's sons are terrible. How did David's sons turn out? Not so great. Solomon might have turned around in the end, maybe. How did his sons turn out? Not so great. You go through the story, the book of Judges, is a story about great judges with lousy kids, right? That being a powerful leader has nothing to do with being a good father, it turns out. In fact, if you read the apocryphal Jewish books, which are not in our canon, and there's a reason they're not, but in the Jewish writings between the Testament, they actually formalize this and they say it out loud. One of the things they tell rich old men, spend your money now and enjoy it because your children may not know what to do with it. Right? Our wisdom is, pass something down to your children. The ancient Jewish wisdom was, spend it. If you did well, God blessed you. Probably didn't bless you twice. Your children probably aren't that smart. Okay? And the Apocrypha is very clear in the book of the Wisdom of Sirach. Your kids are not going to do well with it. They're going to waste it. You're not passing anything down. Spend your money and enjoy it. Okay? That's why it's in the Apocrypha, not in the rest of the Bible. Well, the point is that the Jewish people had this sense that too often turns out to be true, that great men, powerful men, don't necessarily have good kids. So go back and you find your favorite priest. Best priest that ever was priest. How did his son turn out? He died and you got somebody else, or whoever was next in line of succession. It might not even been his son. And there was no guarantee that he was any good at all. In fact, he could have been lousy. Wouldn't it be nice if we had a priest who we didn't have to worry about who the next priest was? Wouldn't that be great? Furthermore, and then we can add this to the discussion, Jewish people at this time were not even being served by the noble priest of the past, but by the political appointments of the present. The days of the great priest was long gone in the background. What's going on in the time of Jesus? Anybody remember the story of Jesus' trials? Who are the priests at that time? The first man he goes to isn't even the high priest. Annas was the high priest in the time of Jesus' early life, but Annas didn't get along with others, didn't play well with others, didn't get along with the Romans. Annas thought it was a good idea to take adulterers out behind the alley and stone them to death. The Romans said, we would prefer you didn't do that. And so Annas is removed from office by the Roman officials. In his place, to add insult to injury, the Romans appoint a man named Caiaphas, who is Annas' son-in-law. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us, Caiaphas, not so smart. He was kind of a bumbling idiot, and everybody knew it, which is why the Romans made him high priest. They put a person in power who they could manipulate. And so when Jesus is on trial, what happens? First, he goes on trial before Annas, because the Jewish people recognized him as having the priesthood and having it for life. But Annas can't go to Pilate and say, crucify him. They have to go to Caiaphas, the puppet, his dumb son-in-law, put in charge by the Romans. The priesthood at this time, before you come and tell me, we need a Levitical priest, the writer says, we don't even like the priest we got. The Essenes are a Jewish group at this time who were so unhappy with the priesthood, they left Jewish society completely, denounced the priesthood and the temple, and said, we're going to have to do something better than that. The Jewish society at this time was completely fractured because they knew the priesthood had become a political game of chess. And so what does the writer here say? Wouldn't it be nice If we could have one of those great priests, the great priests like we used to have, but instead of worrying about who came after him, having him be a priest forever. A priest forever. That kind of priest could actually do the job of the priesthood for the nations. Here it says he is able to save them to the uttermost. And what does he mean by that? Let me clarify. I don't think the writer is saying the other priest saved you a little bit, this priest can save you a lot. I think he's talking about time. A good priest could do a good work for one lifetime. But this priest could do his work forevermore, to the uttermost, to the ends of the ages. A priest that could live forever, could always be there. He could be your high priest. He could be your children's high priest. He could be your grandchildren's high priest. He could be a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. We would never need another priest. So in the text that follows, verses 26 and following, for it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priest, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. Chapter 5 emphasized, we need a better priest. But even if you could imagine a priest as good as Jesus, if you could go back in Jewish history and find the best priest who ever lived, maybe it's Aaron himself, I doubt it, but maybe it's Aaron himself. We don't just need a really good priest, we need a really good priest forever. I don't just need a really good priest, my children need a really good priest. Future generations yet unborn need a really good priest. And so it's fitting, the text says, not just that he would be holy, not just that he would be blameless, not just that he would be all these things, that makes him great, but he needs to be permanent. And that's exactly the person that we have. There was one priest who defeated death. One priest who left his priesthood to no one. In the Old Testament, a priest serves until he dies. Jesus begins his service when he dies. And that is his death and resurrection, that he goes up to the right hand of God. He's just getting started. His story isn't over. It's just begun. The priesthood of Christ endures from that day forward and will have no end. A priesthood forever after the order of Melchizedek. The flawed priest and served until they died. But the Son serves as a priest forever and ever. This is the better priesthood we need. It is the high priest that was available to our parents and grandparents, to disciples in centuries of the past. It is the high priest who will be available for as long as the earth shall stand. It is the high priest who is available today, of whom better things are spoken than Levi or Aaron, but a priest forever and a son. If you would turn to that priest and have him intercede for you on your behalf to God, believe in him in faith and repent of your sins, be baptized, and begin a life in his service and under his priesthood. If you're a Christian who has turned from the way you ought to walk, the same priest who is there when you are baptized is priest today. He is the same as the text. The book of Hebrews ends with one of these great lines, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. And if you need his intercession and prayer, the invitation stands open as we stand and sing. Won't you come?